order, and today we plan on hearing the old Petco amended contract and also North Pole refining in that order. So, Mr. Vaness, you can tell us about the new amendments.
Which one are you starting with, Brent?
I guess I'll give you Petco one first.
Okay.
Goes with this every meeting.
Oh, blue ones all right. I like those tips, thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Fred Vaness. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. Before you presently is an amendment to the agreement, the Alpetco contract. This amendment is dated May 17th. It was approved by the Royalty Board on Friday, May 19th. There are five amendments. Four of them are basically technical amendments. One represents a substantive concession on Alpetco's part from the present contract. If I may, I just go through these very briefly. The first amendment adds in a sentence to one of the definitions in order to make clear that as part of the total project cost, which are the benchmarks that Alpetco commits to, if they purchase crude oil, payments for the purchase of that oil are not to be counted towards achievement of the benchmarks. That in my opinion, was already the case under the existing contract, but various individuals seem to feel otherwise. We thought in the interest of clarification, we would just add a sentence to indicate what was intended. Amendment 2 adds a definition to committed, the term committed to be expended is used in Article 10.2, and we've added a definition which makes clear that what is meant there is contractually binding agreements, contracts, and purchase orders. The third amendment is the amendment which represents something of a concession, substantial concession by Alpetco. This amendment says that Alpetco will not take oil for at least 25 months after the effective date of the agreement. As you recall, in the original agreement, they were entitled to receive oil after they had obtained the financing, a financing commitment for $1.5 billion and take-or-pay contracts for 70% of the product. And the benchmark for that was 18, but some people thought that if they achieved it earlier, which in my view is somewhat unlikely but not impossible, then they could in fact take oil earlier than even the 18-month benchmark. This amendment will make it clear that even if they achieve financing all of the benchmarks immediately, they still cannot take oil until the 25th month after the contract. So that represents a concession. The other part also represents a concession on their part, and that is they will not take oil until they have actually expended at least $100 million. As you recall, under the present contract, the benchmark is 70% for take-or-pay contracts for their products and a financing commitment. So now this adds to that an obligation to actually expend $100 million before they will be entitled to receive oil deliveries. The fourth amendment says that if by the sixth year they have not built a 150,000 barrel per day facility, and in fact the facility will take less than 150,000 barrels, then there is a reduction in the amount of oil to which the state is obliged to deliver El Petco. And this relates to some concerns that people, various individuals, have voiced, saying that under the contract they could really build simply a 30,000 barrel facility and sell the rest. And I do not share that view that the contract allowed that. But again, in order to make the matter clear to those people who did believe that was a possibility, this amendment addresses that situation. The final amendment is also an effort to address that obligation, and that is El Petco. My goodness, must be some sort of Freudian slip. commits to construct a facility which will process 150,000 barrels of crude oil per day. Those are the amendments to the contract which have been executed by the commissioner and by Alaska Petroleum Company. And we submit these with the contract in the hope that the contract as amended will be approved.
Any questions on the point? Fred, on item number 3, there, that really has been tightened, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
It goes, you know, the $100 million falls into the 24-month benchmark, but even in that one, it was still expend or commit to expend or cause contractually bound third parties to expend or commit to expend. At least the here of, I don't think there's any question now that they have to have spent it.
That's right. For those people who had substantial concern that they might be taking and brokering the oil and not really committed to the facility, I would say, I guess I would say this ought to allay everybody's fears. I think it's extremely unlikely that anybody is going to actually expend $100 million purchasing equipment and putting things in the ground solely for simply to obtain oil to broker. I mean, at this point, they're going to be in the business.
And then also on item 4, that in effect is almost a 2-year reduction from the previous benchmarks, right? Because the other one was a completion of 72 months after the effective date for completion of the total project.
Well, but this is 6 years, which, if my arithmetic is right, is the same thing. 6 years.
Yeah, for all practical purposes, you've reduced it down to only 4, right? Or 3 years and 11 months, because the 6 year provision is from the date of the contract, the first 25 months of that.
Well, that's right.
There's no taking.
The construction will be, by the 25th month, they will be in a construction mode in order to expend that much money. And then they will have completed it by the 6 year at 150,000 barrel capacity, or they will simply receive less oil. If it's less than 150,000 barrel facility by the 6 year, then they're going to get less oil, less than that oil, whatever it is.
Okay. Senator Paul.
What part of the contract has the 70% in it?
It's section 10. Wait a minute. The part relating to the 70%, it would be, what is that? Is that 2.4? 2.2? I'm sorry, I should have gone.
Yeah. Sure that I understand this correctly. They can take up to 70% of future discoveries. Up to the point where they have their 150,000 barrels a day, or can they take 70% if it's going to be...
No, up to 150,000 barrels per day.
That's what I thought.
And that's what this provision addresses. That number can go down. See, on the third page here, you see a reference in the amendment to 2.7. There is a reference to Article 2.4. 2.4 kicks in at 145,000 barrels per day. When they drop below that, then they have the right to take the 70%. Now, if under this amendment, supposing they only built a 120,000 barrel facility by the 6 year, then they would only be entitled to 120,000 barrels, and the 145 would drop down to 115. See, this says you get 150. If you go below 145, then you have rights to other oil, to the 70% provision.
To bring them back up to
150. Bring them back up to 150.
Yeah.
That's right. And if we adjust all the numbers down, supposing it's 120,000 barrels is what they actually build, then you have to adjust the 145 down to 115.
Yeah.
Same relationship.
Fred, just for the sake of discussion, there's been a great deal of conversation over some semantics, at least in my opinion, as to processing in state. Those words should be added somewhere in the contract. I want to give us an explanation on why those words are not necessary.
I would be happy to have the opportunity to do so soon. The concern, it seems to be that somehow or other the contract does not expressly say oil must be processed in this facility. And our and we concede that point, that those express terms are not in the contract. However, it is our belief that anybody who is, has expended $100 million and started the construction of the facility necessarily is going to have to use that oil in the facility if it's at all economically viable to do so. You, the amount of money that will have been borrowed to put in the, to build this facility and that is going to require a large cash flow. And the large cash flow simply will not be had if one simply takes the oil and brokers it. The question has been raised, well, what if they go bankrupt, or what if it's just not economically possible to do so? And we ought to, in that case, put into the contract a provision which says that they will use the oil in the facility. Or that if they go bankrupt, we get our oil back. And quite frankly, I think the concerns about bankruptcy are addressed in the contract, and that constitutes a breach, and we would get our oil back. But the concern about what if it was not economically possible to use the oil in the facility, and they therefore did something else with it, is perhaps not addressed. Now, and to that extent, it would be a good idea to put it in the contract. The problem with doing that is they simply have to have the flexibility and have been told by their financial advisors that in order to provide, use the contract as some form of security in obtaining financing, they have to have the flexibility to make the best economic choice possible in a bad situation. If the facility is not viable, then it's not viable, and you really can't force a square peg in a round hole. And in that sense, their bankers are going to say what is the best choice in the bad situation, and that may mean having some rights to the oil. And so they believe, and I quite frankly share that belief, that to put a provision like that in the contract is really to undermine the real intent here, because if they've told us they won't be able to get financing. And if they can't get financing, then we're not going any place with the contract. And for that reason, we reject the notion of putting it in. If they can't get financing, we know at the beginning the deal won't work.
Fred, also, we had transmitted to the committee, of course, the companion measure to this resolution, namely, you know, House Concurrent Resolution 112, which does have an amendment on it. And could you address that amendment for us, please?
I would be happy to do so. Can I have a copy of that? Yeah. House Concurrent. Basically, the relationship between this resolution and the amendments are that it's a reply. As you recall, the position of the governor has consistently been that the legislature can approve or disapprove of a contract, but that they really can't amend it. And quite frankly, I think if you think about the problems associated with negotiating a contract and being able to make a deal and make a commitment, you can understand the problem that I or the commissioner as a negotiator of a contract would get into with not being able to make a offer a commitment to a company. And therefore, we've tried to bring into the picture the legislature and seek legislative direction and advice during the negotiations and prior to the negotiations. I mean, quite frankly, a contract such as this is a very, very significant action on the part of the state. And it is the kind of thing that it's the legislature's responsibility to be concerned about and that sort of thing. So the governor's position that you can't amend the contract is not really based at all on the notion that the legislature ought not to be involved, because clearly they ought to be involved and their direction ought to be sought and taken as guidance. But the House, in this amendment, in this resolution, took the position that they would approve the contract subject to an amendment, and there's some language in the resolution that purports to amend the contract. Legally, that has no effect, and the Attorney General has advised us that the House's resolution is a rejection of the contract, and the House has rejected it. Notwithstanding that, we and Alpetco are concerned that the contract be approved and have attempted to respond in some fashion to the direction, not necessarily the resolution passed by the House, but what we regard as the direction given by the House and quite frankly by other individuals as well. I mean, people in the Senate have expressed some of the same kinds of concerns. And well, as a negotiator, I personally feel that most of the concerns were adequately addressed in the contract. I suspect there's a certain amount of personal pride involved in that sort of thing, and it may also be the case that whether I'm right or wrong is basically irrelevant. If people are really concerned about it, and it can be addressed, then it ought to be addressed. And that was the purpose for the amendment and the relationship between that and that. And the one amendment in here is substantive, and I don't know that really is even the key objective sought by the House in their amendment, but I think it's certainly part of it. And that really is the relationship between the two. Now, I don't know, you probably know better than I what would happen here if you approve the amendment, the amendments as well, then essentially you've taken action with respect to a different matter than has the House. And I guess under legislative rules, it would go to the House it's a different action, and it would go back to the House. At least that's my understanding and perception of what will happen there. But the legal effect of this was a rejection of the Alpetco contract.
Commissioner, if I could you address yourself to the amendment specifically? From a layman's point of view, I read it, and I've read the new amended contract, and it seems to me that the fears that the House raised here have now been addressed in these amendments.
Well, I certainly
maybe said a little differently.
I certainly think that's the case. The fear, as I understood it, was basically the one I referenced earlier on about they could build a small facility and broker a lot of the oil. And I think there are two amendments here, which make two parts of this amendment, which make that clear, and that was certainly our attempt in drafting these amendments to go as far as we could with respect to any of the concerns we've heard by various individuals, both in the Senate and in the House, without really changing the substance of the contract and without undermining Alpetco's ability to put the deal together. Now, if we went so far that Alpetco and their advisors could tell us right now we can't use that contract, then we've gone too far. I mean, if rather than do that, we might as well just withdraw the whole thing. because, and to do the other way, go the other way would really to be to, in my view, put over a masquerade on people, and we just didn't want to do that, be a part of that kind of thing. So I think we've gone as far as we can, and quite frankly, I think we've probably addressed the basic concerns raised by that.
Good, thank you. Any questions? Good, Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Pratt, would you wish to speak?
Mr. Chairman, I won't take any of the committee's time, except that on behalf of my client, we would very much appreciate the committee considering a committee substitute to include the new amendments and exclude the amendment that the House sent over to the Senate. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Pratt? Mr. Benes alluded to the difference between the two resolutions and at least the Attorney General's opinion of what one constituted by passage of an amendment that had not been submitted to negotiation or review by the state's negotiators and the Royal Oil and Gas Board in particular. But he also brings up the question as to the determination I think we have to make, and that's which vehicle we wish to address ourselves to. Procedurally, it seems that maybe we should use House Concurrent Resolution 112 so that instrument could be sent back to the House for concurrence or non-concurrence.
Are there any other people that testify?
No one that informed me.
Are you ready for a motion?
I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that we take House Concurrent Resolution Number 112 amended, delete that portion that reflects the House amendments, and incorporate therein the amendments as mentioned in the document dated May 17, 1978, to the agreement for the sale and purchase of state royalty oil.
Heard the motion. Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, I'll be a no recommendation on the contract out of committee. I think we all realize that we'll see considerable action. We'll be voting on this several more times. I have some questions, but will therefore be a no recommendation. But do wish to see the bill moved out of committee so we can act on it expeditiously.
Thank you, Senator Poe. Do pass.
Same.
No right. Senator Sumner, do pass.
The Senator Pallettis, do pass.
You wish to change your recommendation to individual recs?
I said it. I thought I said individual.
Yeah, I thought he said individual recommendation.
There
was no objection to that.
Thank you. So the next item before us is North Pole Refining contract. Mr. Salides, wish to speak on this matter.
We'd rather have Mr. Gomeski first. Mr. Long, the president of refining, too, also.
Fine. Marcy, does everyone have a copy?
I assume that folder is full of single space, single line testimony there.
And I'm going to read it all.
And he's going to read it all. It'll be June the 12th.
Yeah.
Before you
Again, for the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Fred Boness. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources. I suspect Mr. Salides wants to go second because he and I have a disagreement over something. Fortunately, it doesn't go to the substance of the contract. We were able to work that out in advance, and I think, quite frankly, it's probably a good idea that the matter, which really goes to the statute, the royalty statute, it might be very good for the committee to hear the concerns that North Pole has on that statute. Be that as it may, let me turn to the contract. I believe we've submitted to the committee a summary of the contract, and Mr. Salides has done likewise, and I think the summaries are fairly specific in getting to the basic points of the contract, and for that reason I have not prepared any formal testimony. I guess I'm here basically to answer any questions. I would be happy to summarize the key points of the contract. The key points of the contract are that Earth Resources Company of Alaska, which operates the refinery at North Pole, Alaska, is entitled to purchase up to 15% of the state's royalty oil under certain conditions. North Pole would be entitled to purchase oil from other oil than that which is produced from Prudhoe Bay, and the contract. And that point, there is a correction which needs to be made in the contract, and I will submit a letter clarifying this point to the committee. The agreement between the state and North Pole was that the rights to purchase other oil was to that oil which is available and unobligated. The contract reflects a number of specific conditions, which means that only under very specific circumstances will they get other oil, but it neglects to reflect that one, and that was simply a matter of typing, and I've asked Mr. DeLong for a letter of clarification on that matter, and he indicates that that we'll get that back. That being so, then there are no other problems with the contract. The contract, as I say, entitles them to up to 15% of the oil, provides that they will use that oil in their facility, except in the event of force majeure, in which case we make an effort to try and get the producers to take that oil back. If we are unsuccessful, then they are entitled to sell that oil in-state. They may sell it in-state, but they're entitled in that event to sell it out-of-state. And we have a request from Mr. DeLong for some clarification on that, and we may be back in here next year with an amendment to that provision. At the moment, there's some questions about what we can do to facilitate that. They have some concern about being required to take oil in the event of force majeure, and quite frankly, I think their concern is legitimate, but looking at it from the state's point of view, I don't want to suffered their concern at our expense, and so we're looking for a way to avoid that on both parties, and we may be able to work that out over the next few months. And the contract provides that they will use the oil in their North Pole facility then, and that they will take a minimum of 5,000 barrels a day, and could never take more than 35,000 barrels a day, even if the 15% and what have you, all those things went above, the maximum would be 35,000 barrels a day. Most of the rest of the contract is pretty much standard language or the language of the Alpetro contract. The pricing provision is, of course, the requirement that they pay the in-value price plus bear the risks associated with the lawsuit of any additional or added on costs that occur by virtue of taking in kind. The pricing term covers that. It's basically the same. The security term is very similar to the security term in the Alpetro contract. And this, I suppose, and the state will provide them with line fill, which is a concession on our part. Unless you wish, I would probably conclude there my testimony and answer any questions you have.
Right. Any questions of the commissioner? Fred, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, for the record, my name is L.F. DeLong. I'm president of North Pole Refining. And if it's permissible to the chair and the committee, I'd like to have Mr. Salides comment on some of my comments later when we get into some of the technical language of the statute itself. I think Mr. Benes indicated that there was some discussion between Mr. Salides and himself on clarifying some of the paragraphs in the contract. And it wasn't Mr. Slidey that was delinquent, it was myself. We just got off the plane and I hadn't had a chance to sit with Fred, Mr. Benes. I indicated in the hall coming here that I would sign the change in language. And I'd like to elaborate, if I can, upon that change. I think it's academic, and I would like to express to the committee why I feel it is academic, and I will sign the letter and the change. I'd like to go back a little and give you a little history. When we started negotiating the royalty oil contract, we specifically didn't ask for any quantities other than the fact that we felt that under Alaskan Statute 3805 and the legislators charged to the Royalty Oil and Gas Board, which Mr. Salides will comment later, it says that the first preference for crude is for in-state use. And we felt that that clause, even though we had done a good job in arranging other supplies, we felt that in order to protect the citizens of Alaska, and that's why that clause was in there, that we were satisfied. And I must say that Mr. Benes worked very hard to get that clause in our contract, 3805, and we felt that's all we needed. We felt we didn't need a quantity of 38,000 or 40,000 or 2,000 or 3,000. We felt that so long as the crude oil was required for Alaskans for in-state use to meet all of the specifics that the legislator had outlined in 3805 and the charge to the Legislative Royalty Oil and Gas Committee Advisory Board, that we were satisfied. However, they insisted on this quantity. And I guess I'm kind of confused why they want this clause, if available. And it seems to me it goes to the very heart of the matter of what the legislative intent was. In other words, do the people of Alaska have first call, if they require it in state, upon that royalty oil, as I believe and some other consultants believe the statute states? Or can the state, through an administration, go ahead and obviate that statute and go ahead and declare oil for use outside of Alaska, for non-use in Alaska, and deny the citizens of Alaska. And that basically, I do not think it can. I've read the 3805. I think Mr. Maness and the administration feel otherwise. I'm confident enough to sign the change, but I would like to get on record a concern that I, as an Alaskan citizen, have. And what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Mr. Slides, who might get into some of the language itself. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is this is George Slides speaking on the North Pole Roswell contract. One correction on it is not a change that the administration is requesting. According to the letter which I put in front of you, which was sent from Deputy Commissioner Burness to Mr. Frank DeLong, it is a request to reinsert language which was inadvertently left out of the final copy which was sent to you, and which, according to Mr. Burness, I don't wish to speak for him, but I would ask if it's all right that he would be allowed to interpose if I am misquoting him. He's asking for the reinsertion of language which, according to his records, when the contract was approved by the board, he had made notation that it had been left out and that it would be put into the final typed copy. It has not been put in the final typed copy, and the language again is, as you note, he asked that the words, "if such oil is available and unobligated," and as Mr. DeLong indicated, he will sign it, he's agreed that he will sign that. I want to add my feelings, and very strong feelings, on this matter to this, and I'd like to have it part of the record. That's why we're saying it today. I may even, and that is this, that I feel the whole, that the matter of unobligated is academic, because there is, although Mr. Burness indicated that this matter was not addressed specifically, and of course we agree that the language was left, that those words were left out, but nevertheless there is absolutely nothing in the contract, as you have it before you, which prohibits the state from selling this oil, the additional oil from the other leases, to some other in-state refiner. Nothing at all. And so I feel it's covered. Again, and this is where I think the administration and ourselves part company on this matter, and I know what the legislative intent was at that time. The courts have ruled that the former legislator may not testify as what the intent was, because it actually becomes, the intent becomes diffused throughout the entire legislature as they all vote on it. But nevertheless, we feel this, and we very strongly, that regardless of what words, whether the words are put back into the contract or whether they are left out, if North Pole or any other user of any other entity or refinery that needs royalty oil to supply a local market, and that oil is being exported, then that entity is entitled to that oil. For example, and I don't think this will come about, so I'll use it as an example, but if before the Alpetco refinery it comes online, or the petrochemical complex, whatever they will build, and they are taking oil and exporting it, and in the meantime Tesoro shows a need, or some other refinery not yet known to us shows a need or wishes to build a refinery to supply a local market, I feel that entity has a right to that oil. And that is why we're willing to insert those words back in there again. Because of technicality, they were left out inadvertently. What we did ask, and if you'll see my reply to you, Mr. Chairman, if I might just presume a few more moments, you will note that I suggested that in the last paragraph, that the correction, if they do want a correction, correction should read, if such oil is available and unobligated to in-state use. Because we feel that no refiner, North Pole in particular, can object to another in-state refiner. If we do need the oil, we will invoke, or I would advise North Pole Refinery to invoke all the elements of the statute, which I believe entitles them to oil for in-state use. Mr. Burness tells me that he cannot add the additional language because it would be a change in the language, an amendment to the contract, as it were. And I suppose technically I have to agree. And I know that I have not added or subtracted from the wording in the contract by my testimony, other than to put on record for the future, if the occasion arises, that is our intent, that if North Pole Refinery needs oil to supply the local market and it's being exported, my advice to them, and I think their intention is to invoke the law as they see it and acquire that oil, regardless of what this contract says. I'm not Mr. Chairman, unless I would turn it back over to
the testimony.
Any questions of Mr. DeLong or Mr. Slidas?
I understand clearly what Mr. Slidas is saying. I'm wondering if the department disagrees with the essence of his testimony. Is that is the understanding of 3805?
I would be happy to respond to that. There are a couple of things that one has to take into account. First of all, you have to look at the facts as they would lie or might lie at the time one would come to invoke the provisions of 3805 or 06. First of all, it's a different situation if the state is taking oil in value than if it's delivering its oil to someone else under a contract. Seems to me clear that the presumption in the statute, and with the amendment that took place last year, the presumption in the statute favors taking in kind and favors in-state use. So that if the state were taking in value and someone were to file a lawsuit saying under this lawsuit you've got to provide us with oil because we have a need for it, it might be that the party suing the state would prevail. And the state would be forced to take its oil in kind and deliver oil to whoever was filing the suit. Although, quite frankly, there are obviously some problems with that in terms of putting together the contract. The question of price, at what price the state could be forced to sell to that party, is clearly not addressed by the statute. And I think a court would be hard-pressed to figure out how to address that. It's one thing if the company says we'll pay the in-value price, you just have to deliver the oil to us. It's a totally different thing if the company is saying you have to deliver the oil to us and we're going to pay you a buck less. So that's unresolved, and that provides a bit of a caveat to my conclusion. It's a different thing when you look at whether the state has a contract, such as the Alpetco contract or any other contract, which might provide in-state benefits and also an opportunity to use some or all of the oil out of state for a period of time, a given period of time, be that period short or long. I think Mr. Slidas probably put it is better than I could put it, and that is, each individual legislature, when they vote on the statute, have fairly specific reasons. I'm sure you all know better than I why they vote on the statute. But they may not all be the same reasons. And so that the department and myself, when I was in the Attorney General's office advising the Department of Natural Resources on what the statute really meant or was intended to mean may be different than what any than any of the individual legislators who voted on. And quite frankly, I think if you look at the criteria established, in-state use predominates, but it is not the only requirement in the statute. The statute suggests to me also fostering, using oil to foster additional in-state use. And so that I think a court would have to look at the facts and it would say, does this contract, which someone is saying is invalid or illegal, run contrary to the statute? It may be that a given contract would permit some oil being sold out of state, but still be entirely consistent with the royalty statute. Quite frankly, I believe the Alpetco contract is such a contract, entirely consistent with the royalty statute, yet nevertheless allowing for some period of time use of the oil out of state. And in that situation, I'm just not sure. I am sure. I feel quite confident that the court would allow, and the court would find that to be permissible and would not violate such a contract. And so I guess my response to Mr. Salides is simply that, or to the point that has been raised by Mr. Salides and Mr. DeLong, is I share their belief. But I wouldn't go so far as to say, under all circumstances, the outcome they perceive would be the outcome which a court would find. Now, the reason why I don't believe it's academic, I mean, I guess if I held Mr. Salides and Mr. DeLong's belief entirely, then I would share their conclusion that the correction in the contract is academic and wouldn't be necessary. But I don't share their conclusion that it will always be the case, and therefore I think it's necessary to avoid a situation where the state might be in conflict with obligations to deliver oil more oil than it has. And I think therefore, and I that was originally the reason for including it in the earlier drafts of the contract, as I outlined in my letter. And I know that in the absence of that kind of provision, I think the state would potentially, not necessarily, but would potentially be in a situation which would result in conflict.
Could not, without amending the contract, that for the purposes of at least those contracts existing today, that section be further defined by the state, so that any future contracts entered in by the state would be at least subject to that clarification.
It would be a statutory amendment in the statute. Certainly the statute could be amended to address that if that was the overall objectives. I would point out, I see a number of sort of administrative problems, speaking here as a representative of the department which must carry out the statute. For example, what happens if refineries now, the North Pole refinery is probably a good example, can be constructed and brought to Alaska and put down in place and operated reasonably efficiently and profitably and what have you. If you write a statute which says anybody who brings a refinery into Alaska, causes a refinery to be built in Alaska, gets oil, notwithstanding any other provisions, I perceive some problems as an administrator dealing with that statute. There are some biases in the entitlement system right now which favor small refineries, so that it might be someone looking at a statute could say, well, I like that idea and I'll just take us and build a refinery in Alaska and it will force the state to sell me oil because that's what the statute requires. And I don't really, I can really see some potential problems with that kind of situation.
Yeah, I agree. But I think Mr. Benes was quite concerned about that, and we were too. And there are clauses in the contract. There is a legislative charge to the setting up of the Royalty Oil and Gas Board, which indicates 8 conditions. One of the conditions, and it's in our contract, says for in-state use. Now, there are only so many uses in the state of Alaska, and you can build capacity in Alaska, but you only can sell so much oil. So if you build a refinery in Alaska and you export 60 or 70 or 80% of it, then that does not allow you to get unlimited amount of crude. And we agreed. We've got it in our contract. We say all we wish, and that's our interpretation of 3805, is to satisfy in-state use. That's what we say. And you said it. You said it in the contract. And we agree. We say 3805 is beautiful. We agree. We think it was a beautiful piece of writing, and we feel that the legislature, to make their intent very clear, issued a charge, and it's in the charter of the Royalty Oil and Gas Advisory Board, lays out 8 stipulations. And we agree with them, every single one of them, which defines an in-state user of royalty oil and gas. And it goes into economic development, in-state use, jobs, social conditions, etc., etc. And we agree. We think it's beautiful.
Senator Poland.
Mr. Chairman, if I may make a moment.
Please.
To get back on to the point, we have made our point, I believe, and at least I'm satisfied, and I hope Mr. DeLong is satisfied. But getting back to the contract itself and a comment that Senator Sumner has made, the correction is not an amendment, it's simply a technical correction. Anyway, and so at any rate, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, and unless someone else wants to speak on it, Mr. DeLong has indicated that he will sign this letter. And by signing of this letter, it satisfies all of Mr. Vanessa's concerns. And that puts it back into your lead. Is it up to you what you want to do?
Well, your item 15, Mr. Salides,
yes,
leaves room, you know, next year, no doubt you will probably renegotiate some provisions again to
we do
maybe contractually address the theories that you've spoken to. But I'm going to interpret the last part of your testimony to be advice an opinion that
that's
I
correct.
Think we all share.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And no one do you want that dialogue to interfere with the passage of what you have before?
No, we do not want to. We do not want the dialogue to interfere, and I must apologize in one way, because I know that we introduced a topic which is really not part of your what you're here for today, and yet we felt it was important enough to have it a matter of record. Possibly for
background information.
For background information in our future negotiations. Okay. And I do apologize, but at the same time feel that we had to do that.
Fine, thank you. Commissioner, I'd like to use the House vehicle again on this measure to expedite this contract. Did the House, I don't see any reference here to any letter of intent or amendment.
I believe the
not amendments, I don't want to use that word.
No, right. The question came up in the House, as you can see from my letter, that was the impetus for my letter to Mr. DeLong. I advised them I would look into the matter and resolve it. They went ahead and passed it on the theory that I would do that, and I presume on the theory that it would be addressed in the Senate if it became a problem. It's not a problem, as far as I'm concerned. Passage of the House amendment, passage in the House, and the House resolution is adequate to approve the contract with all appropriate safeguards to the state.
But then would both parties entertain a motion from us to include your letter?
It should be included as part of the record, I would say.
Part of the record only, though.
And it will be included as part of our records in terms of the contract files.
Does that satisfy you, Mr. Newell?
Yes, sir.
We'll entertain a motion then on using the House vehicle, House Concurrent Resolution 130.
No move.
Chairman, is there further resources on this?
there is a referral, and Senator Poland has a prerogative of waiving or taking it for decision.
Well, since the two prestigious members of that committee are present here.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.